to one of the world's respected writers, Timothy Garton Ash, who's devoted the last 10 years or so exploring free speech with all of its opportunities and perils in this early-ish 21st century. He writes in his book, Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World, and I quote him now, "Never in human history was there such a chance for freedom of expression as this. And never have the evils of unlimited free expression, death threats, paedophile images, sewage tides of abuse, flowed so easily across frontiers." Timothy's now the Isaiah Berlin Professorial Fellow at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and the Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, a very interesting twinning. And when I spoke to him last year, it was around the time a visiting British Muslim cleric caused headlines over comments he'd made against homosexuals, quite strong comments a few years back in the US, and it then subsequently caused a political stir here with a review ordered by the Prime Minister of his visa. He promptly left Australia. So I spoke to Timothy Garton Ash about this in relation to freedom of speech and welcomed him to the program.
Very nice to be with you.
Timothy, I don't necessarily want to draw you into the domestic situation here, but we are seeing a pattern of people being banned from entering countries or, say, university campuses due to what they've said in the past. I'm thinking about climate change deniers here as well. Do you approve of this trend?
No, I don't. I think it's always better to confront the person, argue with them, criticize them, expose the crudity and falsity of their views. So, for example, there was a petition in Britain to ban Donald Trump from this country. I think that's completely absurd. I think, on the contrary, we should invite him and then tear apart his arguments. And that is the free speech answer.
In a review of your book, Edmund Fawcett writes in the International New York Times, and very blunt in a way, free speech gave us Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream. It also gave us Donald Trump. It'd be nice to have one without the other, but that's not what free speech promises. It's complicated and comes at a high price. Now, from your very complex book, is this price becoming higher in our more connected world, or as you call it, the cosmopolis?
Well, first of all, we've never been in a world like this before. Essentially, it's a world in which we're all becoming neighbours. I'm talking to you from the other side of the world. Anything someone puts up online here or in Pakistan or in Brazil is instantly visible in Australia. That's an amazing opportunity for human communication. There's been nothing like it in history. You know, anyone can in principle talk to half of humankind, but it also means that preachers of hate and those who are inciting to violence can reach a much wider audience. So it's both. Mm. All technologies are double-edged. This produces a huge opportunity, but also a huge risk.
So why at the moment is there a pushback, a global pushback against free speech, which you say you find especially depressing?
Well, I mean, first of all, that's a fact. I started on this project about 10 years ago. Free speech seemed to be advancing then. There has been the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. There was the Arab Spring. There was some liberalization in China. In the last few years, it's all gone backwards. I mean, for this book, I've been traveling to China, to India, to Turkey, to Egypt. In all of these places, it's gone rapidly backwards. There is a rise of illiberalism. And partly that has to do with the failures of liberalism, particularly the financial crisis. Partly it has to do with states reasserting their sovereignty over the internet. So particularly in the wake of the Snowden revelations, more and more countries have said, well, you know, say what you like about China, but at least they have their information sovereignty. They control their internet. And countries like Brazil and India and South Africa have been quite tempted to follow that example. So I think on many fronts, there is a big pushback against free speech.
Well, in fact, in your chapter on religion, it's quite interesting. It's a very demanding chapter, I must say. You make the point at the start that when you presented to a group of Indian MPs, a diverse group, they at once said, they were Hindu, Sikhs, Muslim and secularist politicians alike, insisted that you could not have a fully free speech, respect the believer, but not necessarily the content of the belief. You couldn't have that in India at the moment. You couldn't risk it.
So there's a great example. And by the way, I think the chapter's demanding because the subject is demanding, as we all know, religion and free speech. So what I do in the book is I lay out a set of what I call draft principles and then explore them in detail. And the one on religion is we respect the believer, but not necessarily the content of the belief. And as you say, a bunch of Indian MPs then jumped up and said, you can't say that, respect me, respect my belief. The reason we have to insist on that is that in a multicultural society, like Britain or like Australia, you have people from every faith and culture in the world. And if you put together all the taboos of all the faiths and belief systems in the world, and so we can't talk about them, there isn't much left we can talk about. So actually we have to insist on some distinction between absolutely respecting the believer, his human rights, her human dignity, and what the Enlightenment has led us to believe in, the capacity and the freedom to challenge and criticise a belief.
Now, you've mentioned the word that I thought sort of threaded its way all through. Is this free speech really Western post-Enlightenment free speech? Is it a Western notion?
Well, there's a really interesting question. So, obviously, it's only in the West, broadly conceived, that free speech has been institutionalized, anchored in law, the way it is in the US or Australia or Britain. But that doesn't mean that people in other countries, in China or India or Burma, don't want it. One of the things I've done with this book, I have a website which we run out of Oxford University in 13 languages. And so I recruit teams of graduate students and guess from which countries the most applicants come. It's not America or Britain. It's China, Iran, Turkey, Egypt. So what's for certain is that in countries that don't have free speech, there's a huge appetite for it. And people find in their own cultures, I mean, one of the things I do in the book is to go back and look at what Indian thinkers and Chinese thinkers have said about free speech. And in the works of Confucius or the Indian king Ashoka, you can find the demand for free speech already there in those countries. So I do not think it's a purely Western speciality.
Let me just tell listeners that Timothy Garton Ash is my guest with his very challenging book, Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. So tell us about your 10 principles then, which you've clearly battled with despite this rather depressing conclusion that things are going backwards. Is your core argument that the best protector is a robust civil society from which everything flows?
So I think, and I mean, you mentioned in your introduction a particular case of a preacher of hate, because there is a kind of, has been a thermonuclear explosion of speech, there is just so much more stuff out there. I think we have to define very clearly and quite narrowly the stuff we're going to go after by law, with the police, with the courts. And I think we have to go after everything that potentially that leads to violence, incitement to violence, threats of violence, the kind of stuff that led to the killing of the journalists of Charlie Hebdo. The rest of it, I think we have to do exactly as you say in a robust civil society. Freedom means working out for ourselves how we talk about these difficult subjects like religion, like race, like indeed politics. And, you know, that's what we do. We should have a right to offend, but that certainly doesn't mean a duty to offend. it's up to us to work out how we speak so that we can have a conversation about all these really difficult subjects.
Well, indeed. Look, you have some wonderful lines that actually schools should prepare people for living with diversity, by talking about it. You also say rather than encouraging people to be thin-skinned, which some might say that sort of creating offence or elevating offence to something that is very serious encourages people to be thin-skinned, what we need is a world of increasing and increasingly intimate diversity, learning how to be more thick-skinned, to live and cope with difference.
Exactly so. And among the threats to free speech at the moment, I would single out, in countries like Australia or Britain, I would single out three. What I call the assassin's veto, which is people like the murderers of Charlie Hebdo saying, if you say that, we will kill you. The heckler's veto, which is the angry mob closing down the play or the exhibition or the speaker. And then, in a way most insidious of all, what I call the I'm offended veto. I mean, more and more you have groups and individuals saying, you can't say that because we're offended. Unfortunately, we have it also in our universities.
Yes.
And that's what we can't allow, is a purely subjective individual I'm offended veto. And that's why I think we have to start in the home and in the school educating people to live with this diversity, to recognize that they're going to be people who have very, very different things. For example, who believe that homosexuality is a sin. You know, that's something that many people, rightly or wrongly, I think wrongly, but in their own belief systems do believe. We have to be able to live with that while drawing the line very clearly when that goes across to incitement to violence, you know, stirring people up directly to attack people of other sexual orientations, as happened in Orlando. So that's a line, but short of that line, I think we have to educate our children and ourselves in what I call robust civility.
Yes.
And actually, go on.
Well, it's a wonderful phrase. And I was thinking about universities because I read recently how US universities are becoming, some people suggest, super PC about what they can and can't teach and discuss. And this appears to be coming to the UK a bit as well. What type of material are you talking about here?
So, for example, some students organised a debate on abortion here at Oxford. It was closed down by particularly the College Feminist Society, who said you can't even talk about that. Germaine Greer, the famous radical feminist, was disinvited from another British university because of her views on transgender people. And I think that's exactly where we don't want to go. The students advanced the claim that they should live in safe spaces, that they shouldn't be confronted with views that make them uncomfortable or disturbing. Actually, a university should be precisely about people being confronted with difficult, different, uncomfortable, radical views so that they can learn to argue about them and deal with them in a civilised way.
I suppose it's about annihilating type language, isn't it? You know, this week we've seen the Westboro Baptist Church highlighted their views about Orlando being God's punishment for gayness was quite shocking, delivered with a beautiful smile and lovely songs by very nice young people. And it was sort of I didn't really know what on earth to do about my feelings about it.
Yeah, good question. You know, no one has a right not to be shocked, right? We couldn't live in, hard to imagine a world in which you're not shocked by anything. I think that they should be subject to the most withering criticism. I wouldn't want to, you know, invite them, but I don't think that this should be banned by law. Actually, you know, in the American First Amendment tradition, there is no what is called viewpoint discrimination. So the mere expression of a view or opinion is never criminalized. You in Australia, like us in Europe, have gone beyond that to have hate speech laws, which are justified as a way of enforcing civility.
Right.
And I don't think the track record of laws, and I've looked at this in great detail, of laws enforcing civility is any good. For example, France has lots of hate speech laws and still lots of racism. You know, so I think this is something, in a sense, it infantilizes us. We should be doing that work ourselves. Right. About working out how we live together well, live with difference in a free society.
Timothy, thank you for provoking us to think, and I really appreciate your time.
It's a real pleasure.
And that was the widely published Timothy Garton Ash, who I think is very popular among RN listeners. We got a tremendous response to that interview. He's Professor of European Studies at the University of Oxford. The book is called Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World, and it's published by Atlantic Books. We'll have a link on our website to the Free Speech Debate website.